Today we're welcoming Patrick Ryan, a cult mediation specialist and true expert on cults, thought reform, and intervention methods. His experience spans decades, and he brings his expertise to those in need through his consultancy work, his programs, and his contributions to publications such as AFF News, a news publication for former cult members of which he was editor, The Cult Observer, Recovery from Cults, and Ethical Standards for Thought Reform Consultants, which he co-authored. He's a wealth of information, and I'm planning to soak up as much as I can today. Hi, Pat.
Hi, how are you?
I'm great, thank you. I really appreciate you joining us today to bring some real-world knowledge to all of these topics.
Yeah, it's my pleasure.
Thank you. So I'd like to start broadly before getting more specific into your works and your history. So with different characters this season, I've made efforts to use the term destructive cults rather than simply cults. So could you speak to what the difference is between those two?
Well, I think we have to step back a little bit because the word cult itself has definitional issues. It's problematic. So when we all have an idea of something that we don't like and a group, maybe that the Jonestown from People's Temple or Solar Temple, that is not good, and people label them a cult. That's, you know, in the general sort of vernacular.
Right.
But really, the term cult is not a pejorative. It really describes a system or a system of beliefs that is closed or focused on a particular ideology. So Mother Teresa, in some ways, would fit that criterion of a cult. So what I look at, or what I call as, and so I'm not making this distinction between cult and destructive cult. What I look at more is the nature of the relationship. So we look at, is there a cultic relationship? So every group is different, and groups change from time to time and from place to place. And people are different from time to time, to place to place. And what I look at, and in our work, we look at the interaction of a particular person with a particular group at a particular time in a particular place. So what, there's some large groups that people might refer to as cults, and you don't have to label them, but even the largest groups, there are people that get benefit and they don't have a cultic relationship with the group. They go, they do a few courses, they may get some benefit, they may not, they walk away. But then there's those people who maybe have climbed up within the hierarchy of a group and have a very intense relationship with the group. So I this distinction of destructive cult, what is a cult, in a way is it's in a little too simplistic. And not nuanced. And what we try to do is have a more nuanced approach to this issue of groups.
Right. That makes sense to me. You are the founder and former head of TMX. Am I right that it's pronounced TMX or is it pronounced TMEX?
TMX.
TMX, I thought so. It's the organization of ex-members of Transcendental Meditation. And there, I'm sure there are people listening right now who have never heard of TM, or Transcendental Meditation. And there are people who have heard of TM, but consider it a harmless, meditation-oriented collective. And then there are people listening who might have some knowledge or experience of it themselves. The fictional meditation-oriented group in Season 4 of Deliberations, which I've called the Temple of Contemplative Science, it's loosely based on TM, as well as a few other controversial groups. As someone with a true breadth of knowledge about the organization TM, would you please clarify for us what it is?
Sure. So I was in Transcendental Meditation from the age of 17 to about 24. So I speak from a personal experience. I am also a graduate of the Maharishi University in Fairfield, Iowa, which happens to be an accredited university through the PhD level. So the relationship I had with TM was cultic. My mother learned TM, and she didn't have a cultic relationship with it. It was just something she did. So, you know, and from your previous question, if we use TM as an example, about 5 million people, we have learned TM. Most of those people are not in a cult. But then there are people that are within the TM organization that were teachers like myself who in some way climbed the ladder and were exposed to the more inner teachings that were kept away from the public at large.
Okay, before you go on, I have a quick question. Are you saying that, sure, that transcendental meditation is a form of meditation alone, but it's also a specific organization, and that organization is the one you became involved with? Or are you saying that depending on the level of exposure and involvement with the organization defines whether or not you had a cultic experience?
Well, transcendental meditation is taught by an organization that's founded by Maharishi Mahesh Yogi.
Okay.
So the people who go to learn transcendental meditation are learning it from a person, a teacher, who has gone through an intense training period to become a teacher. So the teacher, the person who's there, so I'll refer to as an initiator, who's teaching the person meditation, is lying to the person that they're teaching. They're not telling them really what's going on. So they set up a condition where the person thinks they're learning one thing, but the person who's teaching them thinks they're doing something else. So there's different sort of levels of information that's given on. So there can be people who just go and learn TM and have a cultic relationship with it, and there could be the vast majority of people who don't have a cultic relationship. But in all cases, the people, either you have a cultic relationship or not, you've been lied to by the organization about the technique itself, its origins, and its benefits or harm that it can cause for some people.
I see. All right. Thank you. That cleared things up for me. I didn't mean to break you off when you were
No, it's okay.
Talking about your personal experience, because I am actually very interested in your personal experience with TM.
Sure. Yes. So I got involved in high school in 1975. Maharishi Mahesh Yogi appeared on the Merv Griffin Show. I was writing for a small newspaper, and the editor sent me to write a article about TM, because at that time the Phillies were learning. They spring train, and I'm from St. Petersburg, Florida, and they spring train in Clearwater, Florida. So it was sort of an interesting subject to go and write about. But at that same time, TM was being taught in the public school system under a federal grant in some schools in New Jersey, Kansas, and California. So TM in the 70s was in some ways a household name. And so my involvement was I went to basically do some research. I ended up learning the technique, and I was young. There happened to be a TM club at my public high school, and so that was kind of unique. And then the teachers at the local center thought that it would be helpful if I went on an advanced TM course called a rounding course or a residence course for a week. And so I loaded up my car and went to the other side of Florida for this week-long course that was actually taught by Mia Farrow's sister, Prudence Bruns.
Oh!
Wow. Of the Dear Prudence fame, the Beatles song.
Right.
Written about her.
Oh.
And so her husband was the state coordinator or the regional coordinator for TM. And she encouraged me, you know, to go to the Maharishi's University. And still at this time, I didn't have a cultic relationship with it. I was like fascinated by it. I was intrigued by it. But it wasn't until I went to the university in about the third month that my sort of frame of reference as to who Maharishi is, what the teaching is really about, that's when it locked in. And my parents say that when I came home from that first quarter of school, I was like a shell. When I got off the plane, my mother refers to me as sort of being blank, not approachable physically, distant, because I'd gone on a course. The advanced courses in TM are often taught in residential settings. I'll describe the kind of structure of the course. So I was on this course for 1 month, which is 7 days a week. Basically, it's 24 hours a day, where every sort of minute of your day is prescribed. When you get up, what exercises you do, when you eat, what you listen to, you're assigned or you have a buddy who's there at all times with you. You are in class from at that time, maybe 9:30 in the morning till about 4:30 in the afternoon, of course, for a break for lunch. And then in the evening from 7 to 9:30. And then at 9:30, you would have milk and honey and ride the waves of silence to bed, where you were not supposed to talk. And you needed to be in bed at 10 o'clock with your eyes closed to catch this an angel train. It's crazy. So in that month course, the theme of it was called the philosophy of action. And fundamentally what it did, it set people up to believe that Maharishi was infallible, that everything he said is accurate. And so there's a month of videotapes and discussions on a particular theme, the philosophy of action. And the conclusion of that is that a man who is in an enlightened state does everything correct. He's a perfect being. And I came away with sort of this switch in my mind, believing that Maharishi was in some way godlike on earth. And I believe that the organization is set up for people, the educational approach, the educational system is set up for people to come to that conclusion. That's my belief. So in the 5 years I was at the Maharishi University, I spent about 18 months on courses like this in month and 3 month long blocks, where basically my eyes were closed maybe 18 to 19 hours a day, either sleeping, meditating, listening to, chanting, having someone read Hindu scriptures to you, but your eyes were closed. So I was in doing internal states for a huge amount of time. And for some people, that's not very healthy.
Right.
So I ended up at the end of my stay at the university, about the second year, Maharishi introduced these techniques for levitation to save the world, which sounds crazy. It's called the TM City program. And the movement started producing research showing that when people practice this technique in groups, the crime rate would go down, accident rate would go down, the stock market would increase. And they believed it in some sense so much that where there were wars in Mozambique and Israel, Lebanon, Iran, Nicaragua, teams of people were sent to those countries to go into hotel rooms covered in foam rubber and bounce up and down. Theoretically, they were levitating to save the world and to stop the wars.
Right.
So
I mean, it sounds crazy on its face, but again, we all have to understand that this is after a prolonged period of indoctrination that, you're given this type of information. And as for the, is it called flying meditation or levitating, the terminology for that?
Yeah. So at the time that I learned it was called levitation.
Okay.
It was one of a bunch of sort of supernormal powers, invisibility, walking through walls, just a whole host of things. And this was supposed to elevate ones and speed them on the way to enlightenment. So when it was first announced, the professors at the university, these are PhDs from Harvard, Yale, Princeton, good schools, getting up saying that people could levitate. And the university published, or the organizations surrounding the university published literature saying that when people practiced it, the body lifted up, moved 6 foot forward, and gently came to the ground. But in fact, that was not what was happening. They were lying to me and to themselves and to the public. So I eventually, after I graduated, Maharishi was encouraging us to go and create ideal villages where people would live together and do this levitation program. It's about 2.5 hours every morning and 2.5 hours every evening together to transform communities. And I did that.
And a village has the double benefit for them, right, of having you all together, reinforcing your beliefs and not exposing you to necessarily outside information that might contradict with their teachings.
Well, in theory, maybe.
Okay.
I wouldn't go so dark. We moved into very marginal areas.
Okay.
Houses were $1 to $7,000. So we were surrounded by an environment that was not necessarily good. And it was just encouraged that people do this.
Okay.
Wealthy people moved into wealthy neighborhoods to do it. But while I was, and it does in some way, you are in a community that's very tight. I remember I applied to go to a course in India and I was rejected because I had burned the wrong brand of incense. And I'm like, what are they talking about? Then I discovered eventually that my neighbor, who was a physician, had reported me to the Council of Supreme Intelligence that I had were burning the wrong brand of incense. And that was enough to keep me from being able to go on a particular course. So
brand specificity.
Well, brand meaning the brand happened to come from another guru. So to have that incense would mean I had some connection with this other guru, which I didn't.
I see.
It just happened to be what was available at the local store. Whereas if you burn the proper incense at the time, it was Lakshmi Sandalwood, that was a movement authorized incense, and thus you would be in good shape. So it's a little, you know, it gets a little crazy. But what happened in my case is that I have a sister who got involved in a cult. And my father asked me to come to Florida to help talk to her. And I thought, you know, Dad, I'm an outstanding young Hindu gentleman, and my sister's a crazy nutcase. And every time I talk to her, you know, she rattles off this, you know, crazy Christianity. And I came from an Irish Catholic family. So I just sort of, you know, she's a nut. And my father said, look, everyone who's approached her to talk about this group, it was called the Way International, she is cut off. And I think you can do it. And I said, he said, look, I supported you to go to the Maharishi U. I supported you in everything you've wanted to do in your life. And I'm asking you to come and talk to your sister. I think you can do this. So I flew to Florida and my father had all these books to read about the group, you know, do a cram session. We do the Cliff Notes on the Way International. And in those books, there were some criticisms of Maharishi and Transcendental Meditation. And my dad said, you know, I've taken the liberty, I drew some lines through the chapters that we don't think are applicable and we don't agree with. And so the first thing I did was to read those chapters about TM. And it, you know, I found out some surprising information because in the TM organization, people are discouraged, if not forbidden, from reading other gurus' translations of any Hindu scripture. They're forbidden or strongly discouraged from visiting any other Hindu teacher. So what you read, my roommate at the time, when he was at Temple University in Philadelphia, he was taking a course, I think, in religion or philosophy, and he brought the books that were assigned to him, and the local TM teacher said, no, those are negative. And so he canceled the course. He canceled his participation in the university course. So I ended up just talking to my sister, and I got her to come back to Philadelphia to speak with a woman that I tangentially knew who had been in the Way. And so my sister came back with me, and I sat in my own living room. And this woman, her name is Lois Patton, she came in and she started talking to my sister about how groups that are destructive work and how people can have these cultic relationships with them, how hypnosis can be used to change people's frames of reference. And as she was going through the discussion with my sister specifically about this aberrant Christian group, in my head, I was sort of, you know, flipping out a little bit going, oh, my God, this is what happened to me. And as she stepped through day after day, I was realizing this is what, you know, occurred to me. So at the end of those 3 days, I gave myself permission for the first time to ask the questions that I was not allowed to ask. And as I asked those questions, the feedback was not good from the organization. And then I realized, look, they lied to me about this levitation, and I asked for my money back. For the levitation, not for the university, but for the levitation. And the organization said no. And I was like, well, you know, you lied about it. And I have a hard time with this thing that you're not telling the truth. And they said, well, if you think you have a case, sue us. And so I did in federal court in Washington. And sued the TM organization for fraud and negligence. Because basically they were doing psychological research on people like myself, young people, without really informed consent, without proper supervision. They were just doing what Maharishi instructed them to do. And eventually the TM organization in about 1989, 90 settled with me for the case. And so because I, during this time, I was young and sort of pissed off at what had happened, we started this organization, TMX, which was to provide to people, this is before really the internet was available, to provide people information about TM so that they could make a more informed decision. And so the function of TM, or the purpose, was really that. It was to give support to the people who felt they were harmed, and to inform the public that there are parts of this organization that are being kept from you. But with the advent really of the World Wide Web, and people can go on and Google and they can find out these internal teachings that they're being exposed to, and they can make a decision. So the sort of purpose of TMX sort of disappeared.
Wow, I really admire the absence of any like sense of bitterment I'm getting from you, because I mean, you seem to say, well, TM can, if you're not too heavily involved, it's not necessarily a cultic experience. I only ask for my money back on the levitation stuff. And I feel like it speaks to your character that you're not like carrying around this sense of like anger toward the organization.
Well, I appreciate your kindness. I'm 61 years old, and this was a long time ago. I wasn't very, I didn't have that. I wasn't like that when I was 23 or 24. I was pissed off, and
right.
I did those things. But certainly, as one grows and they look at their experiences in life, and I think this is very important. And when I work with people who are in groups or with families, the first thing I have them do is to list all the positive things about the group experience. Certainly there's negative things exist, but there are positive things from groups. And so if you only think that they're negative and you only focus on the negative, then the person who's in a group doesn't have any reality on it. Because I did learn things at the TM University. I learned physics, I learned marketing, I learned finance, I learned all kinds of things. And that's the context I learned them in. Certainly, I could have learned them in other places, but that's where I learned them. So to say that everything I learned in this TM experience was bad would not be accurate, because then I would have to deny all these fields of knowledge that you study at a university. There was this chunk of piece, this 5-10% of what was being taught, which was total craziness to me in retrospect. But it was my experience in life. And so I try to look at it, in some kind of objective way.
Wow. Well, so. I mean, that's wonderful. And honestly, I think what you just said about looking at some of the positives, I'm sure that really softens the blow and kind of like eases the trauma for someone who considers themselves to be like, or discovering that they're in a cultic relationship. And so I can see how that's a valuable thing to remember.
Yeah, it's for me, it's like art. And I think that, in some ways, being in a group, we can use some analogies, but one is like art. So if I walked into your house and you had a painting on your wall, and I don't know, let's say it was of flowers, and I said, oh, that's an ugly painting, then we would have no basis for rapport. But if I looked at the painting that you have on your wall and I pointed out that that's really cool, the way the artist shaded the colors, but I really wonder why they use purple for that flower. I mean, if I can appreciate what you love about something, then I think you have the right to criticize. But if I can't appreciate what you love about something, then it's a difficult thing. And that's my attitude when I'm helping people and families understand these closed systems that their kids or their loved ones may be involved in, that you really want to appreciate what they appreciate. Find that common ground, and then you have the right to criticize. I was working one time with a Catholic monk, he's a colleague, who does interfaith dialogue for the Vatican, and we were talking about the Vatican and its dialogue with Islam. And so he was my friend, this monk, for saying, well, Pat, how do you think that we start the dialogue? And I said, well, I had no idea. He said, well, we start with the Virgin Mary. And I'm like, you know, I just like quizzical look on my face. What does that mean? He said that when Muhammad and his brother were going around and taking down all the iconography in the churches and cutting the crosses off because there's the symbolic forms of God were not acceptable. They took out all of the icons, especially the icons in we're talking about the Eastern Church on the walls. And Muhammad's brother saw one, and the picture of this icon was of the Virgin Mary holding the baby Jesus. And so that's the only one that was allowed to be left. And so that's where they start. They start at a place of common ground. And the common ground is they both believe in the Virgin Mary and they both believe in Jesus. They just have a different interpretation. So you start where we can agree. And otherwise, the discussion would be, we believe Jesus is God. No, he's not. Yes, he is. No, he's not. We get nowhere. So to understand something, you have to appreciate what somebody else loves about it.
Right. And speaking of maintaining trust, after listening to your story, I'm just curious, did your father plan it to happen that way?
Not at all. In fact, my parents were, in some way they were a little shocked. In fact, I didn't tell them I'd left for 3 years because I was too embarrassed to tell them.
Oh.
Because, when I was 17 and learned, my parents, they're Catholic, Irish, took me to the local priest, and I got the priest involved to learn. And everyone, their friends that would talk to me, I would get that person involved. So I got, everybody I knew involved except for my father. I got my mother to learn, my sisters to learn, my nephews, nieces. So I was, in some ways ashamed. You have the sense of a young man's ego.
Of course. It's
telling your parents, oh, I made a mistake, and you spent
$50,000.
Guilt, certainly. So I would go to visit my parents, and my mother would say, Pat, we're eating at 6:30. It's, 4. You better go meditate now so that, when you're ready. And I would just go into a room and sit because I was just too embarrassed to tell them. And so I think my parents were a little shocked because I had, I had been taught by Maharishi to tell the sweet truth, the truth that is pleasing, that's to quote him, and to not delude the ignorant. And my parents would be the ignorant, as would anybody else who doesn't know the truth. And so I had focused on the parts of the organization that I thought my parents could accept. And I didn't share by intention and by instruction the parts of the organization that they wouldn't find acceptable.
Mm.
So I lied to them. I was taught the lie, essentially.
Right. Right. Which I understand is a pretty common theme in cultic relationships.
Yeah. I mean, it can be. So, back to this whole issue of the word cult, when we look at groups, they're all so different. And so some groups have a charismatic leader and some don't. Some groups, I've worked with people who had a cultic relationship with a guru who's dead, who did it all from just reading his two books with no input from anybody else. So people respond to these ideas in many, many different ways. And I certainly responded in a way that in some ways took over myself. I numbed to my feelings. And numb to sort of the pain of others. I think the most distressing thing is that my mom had a heart attack, and TM, we called it the solution to all problems. And so my mother had learned at the time but wasn't practicing, and I called her in the hospital and said, Mom, you have the solution to all problems, TM, and you choose not to use it. So you choose to suffer. When you don't want to suffer anymore, you can end it. And I hung up. It's a pretty jerk thing to do. But at that time, in that context, I thought it was right.
Right. And what would or could ultimately help her?
Yes. Yes. It was going to save her soul. Mm-hmm. And it was very important that her soul be saved. Because at its heart, the TM organization, and like many controversial groups, are concerned about you know, people's evolution, their spirituality. There is that, they have a legitimate concern, and especially the membership in trying to save other people.
Right.
No different than, a missionary. It's just that we were a missionary that said that we weren't a religion. I was a missionary of an organization that hid its true beliefs.
Right. Speaking of your mother, you said that when you got back from that sort of initial month-long period with TM, she described you as blank. And I've read some literature that, specifically from Steve Hassan, who talks about the cult identity taking the place of the authentic identity. Do you feel that in your experience with people who go through this process, do you feel like that is true? There's a cult identity and an authentic identity?
I think that you're always you. And so you can either express parts of yourself or not express parts of yourself. I'm certainly, you work for a company, you go to work, you don't always express what you feel or think to your boss. You don't always express, your next door neighbor brings you a plate of cookies when you move in the neighborhood and they really don't taste good. You don't tell them, you don't like them. So I think that we all don't express fully ourselves in general. So the idea that people and groups have these two identities, I struggle with that idea a little bit. I think that maybe for some people in some groups, that may be true. But I don't see that as a consistent across groups. I think it's in some ways simplistic. And, when you're trying to communicate, very subtle things or concepts to people, it's easier to use models. And that's what they are, is there are models. Models of the authentic self, non-authentic self. These are models. They're ways of explaining. Are they accurate? Perfectly, a cup of water is a cup of water? I'm not so sure.
Right. Right. That makes sense to me. While I was researching all of this, I grew specifically intrigued by the way hypnosis and trance induction are really commonly used as indoctrination methods across the board, in whatever form. And I initially, and probably still do, misunderstood a lot about these two things, or misunderstand. Mm-hmm. So you have developed over 50 programs on subjects that include hypnosis, trance induction techniques, and inner experience, which I thought was an interesting term. So I was hoping you could speak a little bit to the way these things, what they are, how they're misunderstood by the public, and the way they're used by these organizations.
Sure, sure. So first, let's just talk about the word inner experience and how I use it in these contexts. So if you're sitting in a bar having a drink and you see somebody that you're attracted to, you feel emotion or you feel some experience inside yourself. These are, not objective. They're subjective realities. Mm-hmm. So that's something, feelings we're talking about are inner experiences, meaning that no one can see that that's what you're experiencing. So when people have auditory hallucinations, that's something that happens in your head. When you have visual hallucinations, that's something that happens in your head. These are inner experiences. So they're generally actually pretty easy to give to people to have those experiences. And so one model we use to explain the kinds of experiences that people have when they're in groups is a model of hypnosis. So in the context, we'll go back to TM. I can give you some examples from a number of different groups. But in the context of TM, the context said people can fly. They can levitate. The context said that, the internal context, that you have many past lives, millions of past lives. And in this opportunity as a human being, the only opportunity you can evolve toward a spiritual growth, becoming like a god. So in that context, there are past lives. So when we were on this course that was 3 months long to learn to levitate, meditating hours and hours and hours at a time, when they gave us the technique to fly, and I remember being in a room with about 25 other guys, there was maybe 350 people on my course. I'm sitting on one side of the room and, nothing happened. And about two or three days into this, all of a sudden, I hit the wall on the other side of the room. And so my internal experience was that I was flying. Now, objectively, I wasn't flying. it was hopping, but I was in another state of mind. And also during at that time, people would be yelling, working like dogs, like buying like sheep, winking like pigs. I mean, it was sort of a cross between Invasion of the Body Snatchers and The Exorcist too. So the interpretation of those experiences, that's the things that validated it, that I'm sitting on one side of the room, bang, I hit the other side. I feel zooming energy through my body. My body's shaking. Well, that's a context. Those experiences come out of a particular context. In some ways, if we look at the near-death experience, near-death experiences are context-dependent. So a little Hindu child doesn't experience the Virgin Mary in their near-death experiences. A nice Catholic kid doesn't see Shiva. The context we're in helps create the experiences we have. So when we talk about inner experiences, we're first of all talking about things that happen within us. And those inner experiences, I believe, are context dependent. So when we look at a model for explaining to someone why or how they've experienced, why did that happen? So if you would have asked me at that time, did you levitate? I would say yes, because that's what I experienced. So I have a memory that's a false memory. I have a memory of something that didn't occur. I was on one side of a room and I did hit the wall on the other side of the room, but there were lots of little steps in between, but my internal world didn't have those steps in between. So when you have people who have these types of experiences, you want to provide a possible way of explaining how experience comes about. And so, one model.
Oh yes. Go on, please.
Yep. No, please.
I just wanted to, clarify. So you were trying to move across the room and you were sitting on the floor,
move. Right.
And you moved by sort of bouncing forward bit by bit.
Yes.
And you hit the wall. And because of the circumstances in which you were doing that, you perceived yourself to have levitated that distance.
Yeah, zoomed across the room, and there was a gentleman on my course that was elderly. He mostly spoke Yiddish, and I was screaming three words in Yiddish: "Mother, home, and bottle." So this became the proof that in my past life I was Jewish, and that is how would I know "Mother, home, and bottle." I mean, how would I know in Yiddish that? You know, it's not possible. I didn't grow up in a community, you know, where would it come from? So these were validations that I truly was from my past life, these things. And the experience of going across the room was of like feeling, it was like bolts of energy flying up your spine, your head is shaking back and forth, and you're physically pushing yourself off, but your attention is somewhere else. And so you don't realize that that's what you're doing. So that context helps dictate the experience. So just on the hypnosis piece. So hypnosis, the word in a way is a misnomer. When we talk about hypnosis, we're talking about a sort of collection of styles of approaches to bring someone into the state of suggestibility or trance. And so for some people, that's very easy to get people to go into that suggestible state. And in other people, it's more difficult. So there's some scales to measure who's more hypnotically suggestible, who's less hypnotically suggestible. Interestingly enough, that hypnosis and creativity are tied hand in hand. Really. People who are more suggestible tend to be more creative. If you're kind of a person who, when you're reading a novel and you're totally engrossed in it and someone walks in the room and you're not even realizing they're walking in the room, your attention is so focused on an idea within the book that you miss what's going on around you. When we're at a football game or a match and your team wins and everyone is cheering, you're in a state of reverie, your critical thinking is slackened off to some degree. So there are lots of ways to get a person into that sort of very focused state of awareness. Rhythmic drumming, chanting, meditation, guided imagery. They're all sort of approaches to bring someone to this suggestible state. And then when we talk about suggestible states, we're talking about the person is focused on a particular thing at the expense of everything else around them. So that the information that's being provided, the education that's being provided, is not necessarily, for some people, critically examined. it's accepted. So in some ways, it bypasses that BS meter we have. It says, that doesn't sound too right. That critical thinking ability, the contra-arguing that happens in our brain, like I'm talking, you're listening, and you're thinking about what I'm saying. And you're like, that makes sense. That doesn't make sense. You're contra-arguing. If we can in some way interrupt that so that you go into a state of mind where you just accept, where it induces a feeling in you, then the person who gives you that experience in some way controls you.
Wow. I mean, yeah, I follow you, and given your explanations, I have a feeling I'm pretty hypnotically suggestible because I tend to zone. I zone out very easily, and there are definitely times when someone's trying to get my attention, and I just won't.
You're focused.
Yes.
And so, interesting enough, in the TM context, the first piece of research they show you when you learn TM is that TM is not hypnosis. And the example that they say that when TM, your metabolic rate goes down, and hypnosis, your metabolic rate goes up. That's total BS, because TM is 100% hypnosis. It's this classic hypnotic induction technique when you teach someone to meditate. And so I remember when I was suing the Maharishi for this fraud, I had a very famous psychologist who had treated the prisoners of war who came up from Korea to be my expert witness. And the first thing she said is, I think you're hypnotically suggestible. And I said, no, I'm not. Because, you know, for meditation, it's just the opposite. And she said, really? And so she asked me, well, how do you think that I would hypnotize somebody? And so I said, well, I'm not sure. She said, well, if I was. And she started describing this thing that she would do. And then her doorbell rang and I was laying on the floor, and my friend walked in and goes, what happened to Pat? And she said, oh, he thought he couldn't be hypnotized. You know, she said, you're very suggestible and it's very easy to get your mind into that state. So, you know, you have a vulnerability. And so that vulnerability has good parts. You're more creative, but you've got that other part. And so there's a researcher in Canada at Laurentian University. His name is Michael Persinger. And he describes the scale of hypnotic suggestibility. And I think he has a 1 to 7 scale. So number one is somebody who's least likely to go into that state of mind. And number 7 are people most likely to go in that state of mind. And so there are surgeons who do surgery on people without any anesthesia, people who have an allergy to anesthesia. And in our work, we actually use some of those training tapes for physicians to show people, you know, how you can do a surgery on someone, cut them open, take their gallbladder out without them realizing, or they're focused on something else. They're focused on the idea of skiing. They're focused so much that they dissociate from what's going on inside themselves. So Persinger said that there's only a small percentage of population, maybe 5%, who are that hypnotically suggestible. But that when people practice techniques that repetitively bring someone into those suggestible states, they can be moved along the scale toward more and more suggestibility. And so I think that this is what happens in, you know, most groups, and specifically in TM, is that most people who learn stop meditating very quickly. But those who this particular approach, this style of hypnotic induction gels for, it locks it in.
Wow. Okay. Well, I appreciate the detail you went into, especially in terms of inner experience, because that gives me a greater understanding of what you mean by that term, which seems hugely relevant.
Falling in love.
It's a very
falling in love is not. It's not rational. It's not intellectual. It's emotional. And so if you can give people an emotional experience, for some people, that locks them in. For other people, it's not so much. For some people, intellectual ideas of fascination can lock you in. For other people, not so much. For some people, just having a sense of community can lock them in. For other people, not so much.
Right, which is why there are a broad range of tactics explored. The best way, I imagine, to not be in a cultic relationship is to prevent yourself from getting involved in the first place. And I know people join clubs and collectives and groups, and they sign up for courses and workshops, and they try different forms of therapy, and they do this, mm-hmm. they do this every day. We're always striving to mm-hmm. to broaden our understandings and gain experience. And most of these are mm-hmm. great and helpful and enhance your lives. They're probably not destructive. But for those that are, I was just wondering if you had any insight as to whether there are any red flags that members or potential members can identify very early on in a recruitment process.
Yeah, I mean, if your gut tells you something's not right, it probably isn't right. Mm. If the person or the group is telling you, you'll find out that the next day, that's on the next course. That explanation is it comes in the future. These become red flags, but fundamentally, you know, when someone promises you something that you think is so fantastic and almost unbelievable, it probably is.
Yeah. But,
so when you meet the nicest people in the world who are caring and loving, who are in sync with you, but they have some fantastical ideas, like people can levitate, it might be a little red flag. So, you know, there are all kinds of these human potential groups that, for some people are beneficial, and for some people they're not beneficial. And so I think that people have to, first of all, you know, you're going to look at a group that you're interested in going to, a training, a corporate training, whatever it is, you know, Google it and see if other people have had different experiences with that group. But we all have vulnerabilities and needs at different times in our lives. You know, I live in Philly, and there's some elderly people in the neighborhood who they're vulnerable at this stage of life. One is 85, 95. And so they need help. So they're in a vulnerable state, and they're more willing to say to somebody like me, Pat, will you go pick up my medicine and give me $100 bill? Because it's the need of the time.
Right.
And there are other times where the person would not give a stranger $100 to do that. So I think that we all have these periods that we're vulnerable and not as vulnerable. Periods of transition in our life, from, you know, high school to college, college to a new job, after a marriage, a breakup. There's times where we're more vulnerable. But in general, the people who are in groups are people who are idealistic and want to make a change. They want to make the world a better place. They don't join groups because they don't want to improve, but you can get stuck in this improvement racket in some ways.
Right.
Because many groups I'll just skip and try to hit it from another angle. In Africa and in most traditional cultures, there are ceremonies for rites of passage. And these ceremonies or processes are important, like when a young man becomes of a certain age or a young woman reaches a certain age, there's rites of passage. And so in some cultures, there are rites of passage which involve circumcision of a 13-year-old child, which doesn't sound very fun with no anesthesia. But prepare for that. There are a whole preparation, because this is a rite of passage of chanting for days, drumming, and a person gets into a state of mind. This is a rite of passage. And then this transformation takes place. And what groups do is often have learned these different sort of rites of passage, and they keep you stuck in them. You never move through to the other side. And so when you see people that are in a group and they've been there, why are these people in? If it's supposed to make you better, when do you graduate? When is it over? You know, you go to college, you want to be a doctor. There's a place when it's over. You get your degree and you set for your test. But groups in some ways don't like these graduation ideas, and they keep you stuck in the rites of passage, these rituals that are done over and over and over again, that in some societies had a purpose, but in our society, maybe not so much.
Right. You're just being frozen. It's that static stage of transformation.
Yeah.
Right at that pivotal point.
Yes.
For anyone listening right now who knows someone or suspects someone a friend or a family member that might be in a group that's harmful to them, or in a cultic relationship, or both. Is there any advice that you can share?
I think that the most important thing is to stay connected to them, and in my mind, at all costs. The research indicates that about 1 million people join and leave groups every year in the U.S. The research, it's not perfect research, but indicates about 90% of the people who join groups leave on their own. Now, that they leave after a day or 20 years, 50 years, that's another question. But most people leave. And so do you have, on the outside of the group, do you have, and can you create an easy glide path for someone to come out to? Are you there, and are you safe to that person to be able to talk about what's going on, or what the person's feeling? Because I know in my own experience, and I think it's the experience of most people in groups, groups are demanding, you know, depending on the group, and it's work. And so there are times when you don't like it. And I refer to those as windows of opportunity. I believe that we had a conversation like this as a stranger, at times could have gotten me to say, oh, TM's crazy. This is not right. And there were other times where you could bring in an army and I wouldn't budge. And the difference would be a week. All you had to know, though, was what was going on in my head. And the only way you can find out what's going on in someone's head is to have a relationship with them. So I think that the advice in general is to stay connected, because relationships are more important than beliefs. Because it's a relationship is going to be your lifeline out of a destructive system or a destructive relationship. If your family or the people on the outside are critical constantly of what you're involved in, what's the last person you're going to talk to? I mean, you're not safe. You've got to. It creates defensiveness, and so it's easier when you're in a group to have an enemy on the outside. Then you don't have to feel what you're feeling, because people are attacking you. You have a common enemy. It binds you together. When you don't have a common enemy, and the people that love you on the outside of these systems or abusive relationships are there for you and they're understanding. Maybe they're mildly curious about what you're doing. They're savable. Then a person is more likely to maintain a relationship. But if, you know, a family or gets on the bandwagon, you know, beating up on some particular group, I think it creates more of a problem. And if we circle back to what I talked about when I left the group TM, I didn't tell my parents for 3 years because in some way it wasn't safe to tell them. Yeah, they were very safe people. It's just that, you know, a young man's ego didn't like saying I was wrong to the degree into which I was wrong. So in some sense, it wasn't safe for me. Now, I don't know exactly how my parents would have changed that, but my advice to most people and most families is do everything you can to stay connected. Because most people will, if you're an open person to them, you listen, you're curious, you have an intellectual curiosity, you show respect to the person who's in a system, then they're more likely to tell you what they like and they don't like. But if they have to prove you wrong, then it's not a good place to be.
Right. And I think that's not only valuable information in terms of advice, you know, preserving relationships, but I think that I think it's a really meaningful statement that when you say relationships are more important than beliefs, and
they are.
I'm going to remember. I literally wrote that down. I'm going to remember that, and I you know, thank you for sharing that statement,
sure.
Not only with me but everyone, because I think it's really significant. Sure. So, you know, I want to thank you for your time, for your knowledge, for your advice,
sure.
Pat. And lastly, if someone wants to learn more about you or your work or anything we discussed, how can they do that?
Mm-hmm. We have a website, cultmediation.com. And you know, it's funny, we're using the word cult, and I don't really like the word, but it's the word that, you know, people are associated. We talked for a few minutes at the beginning of this about that word, but you can go to that website.
It's a very familiar word.
Yes. So I'm also associated with the International Cultic Studies Association, and their website is ICSA, home.com. And it's the largest academic organization that studies this type of phenomenon. And through ICSA, we do these workshops and for families and ex-members to help them make a transition to, you know, a life that doesn't have these bounded choices that groups can provide. So I'm also on their website, but there are lots of resources that are available for people who want to explore helping people maybe reevaluate their decision, or at least how to maintain a relationship with them, even though it's a very difficult thing to do.
Absolutely. And I think Cult Mediation and ICSA are doing tremendous work in this field. And thank you for, you know, committing your life to, helping others.
Well, you're very welcome.
Thank you to everyone for listening. On next week's episode, Lola speaks to the way she was introduced to the temple, while cult expert Stella Laughlin discusses real cult recruitment tactics. See you then.